Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. We hear from scholars Jennifer Lowenstein, Francis A. Boyle, and Con Hallinan. First, this news update on wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Gaza. Ideabeats.org has an archive of Bush audio on the Iraq War. Listening to the site, it soon becomes obvious that the entire Bush administration was lying its way into an invasion, war, and occupation of Iraq, and then joining in the effort to falsify information before U.S. Congress and the American people in order to maintain that war. This was George W. Bush speaking about the war back in October of 2007.
The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. It has given shelter and support to terrorism and practices terror against its own people. The entire world has witnessed Iraq's 11-year history of defiance, deception, and bad faith. We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth. We resolved then, and we are resolved today, to confront every threat from any source that could bring sudden terror and suffering to America.
Here he is again, just before leaving office.
Did we fight the wrong war? And absolutely, I have no doubt. The war came to our shores, remember that. We had a foreign policy that basically said, let's hope calm works. And we were attacked.
Bush was being interviewed by NBC News anchor Brian Williams.
But those weren't Iraqis.
No, I agree, they weren't Iraqis, nor did I ever say that Iraq ordered that attack. But they're Iraq is part of the struggle against the terrorists.
Bush and others in his administration repeatedly tied Saddam Hussein and Iraq to 9/11, a clear deception since the U.S. knew there was no Iraqi link to the attacks on the Trade Center towers. So what should happen to the former president or his vice president, Dick Cheney? What about other key figures such as Karl Rove, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld? Such questions get little attention from the corporate press anymore, and the Obama administration has been guiding us all away from questions about accountability and urging us to focus on other pressing matters at hand, such as our collapsed economy. Obama's proposed Executive Accountability Act of 2009 would hold top U.S. officials accountable, but it's not retroactive. With U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan taxing the economy further to a breaking point, President Obama has just recommitted to an escalation of troop levels for Afghanistan. Some 3,000 U.S. forces have already arrived in Karbala, and Obama has just approved a request from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates for deployment of a Marine Expeditionary Brigade later this spring and an Army Striker Brigade as well as support personnel later this summer. During a press conference with the U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Holbrooke, Afghan leader Hamid Karzai said he had a plan to include Afghanistan in America's war on terror.
I received from Ambassador Holbrooke the message of President Obama, the verbal message of President Obama. I'm very, very thankful that President Obama has accepted my proposal of Afghanistan joining the strategic review of the war against terrorism in the United States.
The president says his troop increase was requested by General McKiernan and supported by Secretary Gates, the Joint Chiefs, and the commander of Central Command. But he adds that the buildup in Afghanistan still depends on the successful drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq. Obama has long said he would get U.S. forces out of Iraq, but his timetable has been linked to the state of security in Iraq, and February 2009 has been a very violent month. 8 U.S. soldiers have been killed thus far, 5 by IED weapons and 3 from non-combat-related injuries. Over 3 days last week, there were a series of explosions in Baghdad, Diyala province, Nineveh, and other parts of the country, with some brutal targeting of Shiite pilgrims making their holy pilgrimage. In coverage for Interpress Service, journalist Dar Jamail reported, an 8-year-old Iraqi girl was shot by U.S. soldiers when their convoy ran into a crowd of Shiite pilgrims traveling to the holy city of Karbala in southern Iraq. There's been a marked increase in violence in Iraq over the past few weeks in general. A series of suicide bombings took the lives of nearly 100 Iraqis, with 80 wounded in one incident alone, as mostly Shiites have been attacked in places like South Baghdad and Musaib, 35 miles south of Baghdad, as well as Diyala province, Nineveh, and Salhudin. The violence in South Baghdad was reminiscent of violence in Iraq during earlier months, as there were back-to-back car bombs in a busy marketplace and at a bus depot with 16 deaths and 43 wounded. According to McClatchy News, there's also been an increase in sectarian violence in Mosul. Many of the latest victims were Iraqi women and children walking to Karbala to make Ashura, a sacred holiday where Shiite Muslims mourn the passing of Imam Hussein. Sunni politicians have also been attacked, as sectarian violence overall has been on the rise again. 6 European leaders visiting Jerusalem have committed to ending the arms smuggling into Gaza, that after Hamas announced a 1-week unilateral ceasefire, asking that Israeli troops leave Gaza immediately. The leaders include Czech Prime Minister and EU President Mirek Topolánek, French Prime Minister Nicolas Sarkozy, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, British PM Gordon Brown, and Italian PM Silvio Berlusconi, as well as Spanish PM José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero. The Gaza death toll continues to climb above the 1,300 number given by Palestinian rights groups. 6,000 were wounded, and doctors in Gaza continue to call for more medical supplies urgently. Now Israel's outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says the blockade of Gaza will be lifted only after captive Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit is released. Olmert says, "We want first to resolve the Shalit issue, and then we will look into the reopening of crossings and the rehabilitation of the Gaza Strip." Israeli forces are still targeting Gaza with artillery fire in attacks that killed 4 people east of Abasan. 6 Palestinians were injured during an Israeli missile attack on a woodworking factory in Jabalia refugee camp. The UN Board of Inquiry is already investigating Israeli attacks, which killed and injured Palestinians sheltering at a UN compound in Gaza. And UN agencies and the international media now use the term militants in Gaza when issuing reports on rocket fire coming from Gaza toward Israel, that after groups other than Hamas have claimed responsibility for the fire. On February 13th, Israeli patrol boats opened fire on Palestinian fishing boats. Israeli troops opened fire on a group of Palestinian farmers working close to the border area. And on the 15th of February, Israeli tanks and bulldozers entered Gaza and leveled the land southeast of Maghazi camp. Finally, the UN is searching for unexploded weapons fired by Israel during the recent Gaza offensive, including aircraft bombs and white phosphorus shells. The ordnances were being guarded by Hamas and were scheduled to be disposed of by the UN, according to the BBC. We spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein, an expert on Palestinian issues, as Israelis went to the polls last week. She'd just been in Lebanon, and we asked her to talk about the climate there as Israeli forces bombed Gaza.
I was there from January 5th to about the 15th, a little under 2 weeks, and I don't think there was a day I was there that there wasn't some kind of protest against the Americans and the Israelis. There were cases where Lebanese protesters were chaining themselves to the gates outside the American embassy in protest. You had enormous protest rallies staged by Hezbollah. I don't mean staged as in they weren't spontaneous. I mean, you know, run by them or headed by them. These protests were happening every day. The atmosphere in Lebanon was very tense and very, very angry. in cities to the south of Beirut, such as Sidon and Tyre, the city streets were plastered with posters in solidarity with the people of Gaza and with images that we don't see on our television screens here because our news media like to tell us that they're too disturbing for Americans to view. The Lebanese in general have very long memories, and it was only 2.5 years ago that Israel was doing in Lebanon and in Beirut what it was just doing in the Gaza Strip. Not identically, but close enough. More than 1,000 civilians killed, infrastructure damage, villages razed, massacres of civilians. I mean, these things are happening in the Middle East, being caused by Israel on such a regular basis that it's difficult to try to make people here understand how angry and how, I can't think of the right word, outraged people are. Enough. There's this saying, enough is enough. And I think many people there are basically ready to take up arms against Israel. I don't think that's going to happen, but you have that kind of broad popular attitude of this country is poison in our midst. And that is very disturbing, not because I am pro-Israel, but because it portends many more years of conflict and of hatred and whole generations of people who are going to grow up with no other memories of Israelis other than as killers. What does that mean for the future?
One thing to notice about Lebanon and what you described is that no one was opening fire on the protesters. In fact, in places within the occupied territories and Gaza too, we saw demonstrations and the Israelis were opening fire.
Yes, that's a significant difference. But of course, the Lebanese government, well, it's hard to talk about the Lebanese government as a unified whole, but certainly Hezbollah, which is the strongest faction, doesn't need to open fire on the demonstrators because it's completely supportive of them, as are many of the Sunni politicians, and I should add, some of the Christian factions as well. In other words, these are demonstrations that are supported by most of the government of Lebanon. Now, that's not true in a place like Jordan, which has had for many years strong ties to Israel, economically and otherwise, but where the population is becoming more and more upset with the image of King Abdullah as a collaborator. And in fact, Abdullah had to replace many of his top ministers in the Jordanian government with Bedouin, people whose loyalty could be more counted on. They had to get rid of Palestinian ministers or ministers who were sympathetic to the Palestinian cause because there's so much fear that the government will be destabilized by these very forces that are pointing the finger at Abdullah and his regime as they, you know, sit together with the Israelis clapping each other on the back. I mean, it's easy to understand why there were so many demonstrations, not only against what's happening in Gaza, but against the Jordanian regime and the Egyptian regime.
And even as the Obama team, again, tries to make changes in the way the U.S. deals with various leaders in this part of the world, I'm just wondering how the Lebanese leaders are going to deal with, on the one hand, a population that's very angry at both Israel and America, because America arms and supports Israel. Mm-hmm. And then also Syria. I mean, again, you have a government that has tried to reach out time and time again during the Bush years, now obviously is going to try to build inroads to a better diplomatic initiative with America. And yet now they're going to be up against questions from their population too, right?
Well, and you have Netanyahu ruling out any possibility of returning the Golan Heights, which I happen to believe the other politicians, I think that's their policy too. They just aren't stating it as honestly. But I wanted to go back to something you said about the American administration seeking to make changes in its Middle East policy You see, I don't see that. I see top Middle East analysts around Barack Obama who are recycled figures from the Clinton administration and earlier, people like Dennis Ross, Martin Indyk, Daniel Kurtzer, Rahm Emanuel, who are right-wing, who have vested interests in Israel and its welfare. These are all people like Obama himself who have come out repeatedly and said, we will not talk to Hamas. And there's not going to be peace in the region without talking to Hamas. So that in itself represents more of the same stagnation that we've seen and despair and violence than it represents any kind of change, you know, on the horizon. It's not there. With Hamas out of the picture, nothing is going to be accomplished. And when George Mitchell made his tour to Israel and avoided going to the Gaza Strip, that to me said it all. It's almost as if you're pretending the most important object in the room isn't there.
I guess the one thing that they are trying to change is the way American leaders negotiate with the leaders of other superpowers, Russia, whether or not we will get along with the leaders of France on this question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in the UK are demanding change. They're angry about what's going on in Gaza. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair has said, maybe we should talk to Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have sort of a trend of pressure growing in the world now.
Yes.
That Israel has done what it's done. But I guess the question is, will the Obama team be responsive to that, and or will they stick to relegating the whole question of Palestinian existence into the corner as usual? And that's been pretty much the status quo for Palestinians, you know, leaderless people in one sense, because their leaders are not allowed to talk to anybody.
Well, of course, it's been that way, I mean, for at least 60 years, and really much longer if you look carefully at the history. I'm not optimistic about any positive changes in the near future. I don't know how much worse things have to get before somebody in this country gets a clue or grows a spine and says, you know, it's time for us to say no to what the Israelis are doing rather than supporting it wholeheartedly with money and arms. I would like to see that happen. I certainly don't see Israeli regional policy as in the United States' interest, but the United States does. And one of the reasons for that is because Israel is a strategic foothold for the United States in the Middle East. It's the forward base of American U.S. military power. It's there on the ground. It's loyal. It's testing all the state-of-the-art weapons that it's got from the United States in areas like the Gaza Strip, where flechettes, cluster bombs, phosphorus, dime bombs, these are dense inert metal explosives, all of these things were used during the last Gaza offensive. All of them are illegal. We have to see this for what it is. It is the forward guard of American military presence in the region and a testing ground for weaponry and policies against people who don't do what we say.
Jennifer Lowenstein is Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She writes for Counterpunch magazine and Middle East Report online, marip.org. We turn to international law expert Francis A. Boyle of the University of Illinois Law School to ask about U.S. policy toward Israel and the Palestinians.
Well, of course, this problem there with respect to the Palestinians has been there since 1948 when the UN, under enormous U.S. pressure, illegally decided to carve up the mandate for Palestine that originally had all have been promised to the Palestinians as their state. So, yeah, it could be that Obama is just going to decide to kick the can down the road for the rest of this first term, and maybe the second term as well. That is certainly what President Bush did for two terms. And in the meantime, fully supported the Israeli persecution, repression, and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian. We have to understand that what they say in public is one thing, what they do in private is another. And what they do in private is give full support to these Israeli anti-Palestinian policies. And the longer this goes on, you know, we could very well see a third intifada in occupied Palestine. Unfortunately, because of his lackadaisical performance here in the current crisis, President Abbas and Fatah have lost an enormous amount of credibility. And indeed, his term as president of the Palestinian Authority has expired. So, you know, it could be that we will be seeing Hamas moving to the forefront and pretty much taking over from Fatah, and a third intifada that will or could spill over into conflict between Israel and Lebanon and Syria. Remember in the 2006 when Israel was attacking Gaza, Hezbollah decided to engage some small-scale maneuvers on the border with Israel to relieve pressure on the Palestinians. Then Israel attacked Lebanon. There was a terrible war, and Hezbollah came out on top. During that course of that war, the Bush administration neocons were also encouraging Israel to attack Syria. So you would have had war in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria as well. So that is the danger of this situation not being brought under control, that, you know, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, this thing could easily spread.
International law expert Francis A. Boyle of the University of Illinois Law School. Journalism scholar Con Hallinan is a foreign policy analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. He has long been concerned over Israel's militancy toward the West Bank and Gaza. We asked him for his assessment of the cost of Israel's blockade of Gaza and some thoughts on where Israeli policy is leading.
The blockade has to stop. And in fact, if they were to stop the smuggling, of which arms do come through the tunnel, but if they were to stop the smuggling, you would literally have a major malnutrition crisis in Gaza. I mean, that's how most of the food gets into Gaza. Now, the refusal to talk to Hamas, one hopes that Mitchell's going to back down from that position. It would be like if he had gone to Ireland and said, well, he will talk to the parties, but he refuses to talk to Sinn Féin or to the IRA. Well, if he didn't talk to Sinn Féin or the IRA, they'd still be killing each other in Northern Ireland. There never would have been a Good Friday Agreement. The fact is that whether one likes them or not, you have to talk to Hamas. And the fact that they say, well, I don't want to talk to Hamas because Hamas doesn't accept the existence of the State of Israel, well, neither did Fatah, neither did Arafat. And when the election happened and the Hamas won the election, instead of giving Hamas an opportunity to say, okay, you know, let's see whether you're serious and whether we can't sit down and talk with you, instead of doing that, the Israelis said, well, we're not going to talk to you, and they launched the blockade. If Mitchell continues to take that position, then I don't see a way out of this. What I do hope about Mitchell is that he is experienced enough and that he remembers enough from his Irish work that the whole idea of negotiations, the whole idea of getting two communities that hate one another, don't like one another, to sit down and come to a raison d'etre, is to get people, regardless of what their politics are and regardless of what they're like, to sit down and talk. And you have to talk to everybody. I mean, it wasn't just the IRA and the Sinn Féin, but it was also talking to some of the Protestant paramilitary groups that were pretty awful people. But they're part of the process. And if you don't include them, they make themselves felt, whether you include them or you don't include them. So I think an approach which says we're not going to talk to Hamas is simply a way of saying we don't want to establish a two-state solution. We don't want to touch the settlements. We want the settlements to expand, and there isn't anybody to talk to, and there won't be any peace. And the fact is that the Israelis can militarily enforce that. One of the things they demonstrated in this last in the attack on Gaza is the enormous capacity for dealing out destruction that the Israeli army has. I mean, they did the same thing in Lebanon. You know, they really set back Lebanon 30 years. They just flattened infrastructure all over the country. They have a tremendous power militarily, the fifth largest army in the world and the largest army in the Middle East. And they were hardly up against, soldiers. In Gaza, they were up against civilians armed with AK-47s and grenade launchers. So it wasn't exactly what you call a fair fight in any case. But I think that if the Israelis take that position and they intend to just simply delay and delay and delay on the two-state solution and resort to military force, then I really question whether or not the two-state solution ever would work. I mean, what I see here is an existential threat to Israel, and that is that if the Israelis continue to follow the path they're following here, I don't know where Israel is going to be 100 years from now. I'm not sure that in fact there will be a country, unless it's this little military enclave like Sparta or something. And even there, I can't imagine that most Israelis would want to live in that kind of society. So I think that what you have here is, and what Gaza has done, is that it essentially has created this enormous fork in the road. And the Israelis are going to have to decide what direction they want to go. And if they want to go in the direction of Netanyahu and Lieberman and people talking about transferring the Arab population out of Israel, loyalty oaths, essentially further militarizing Israel, stripping away whatever democratic institutions exist, and making it basically a siege country, then in the long run, I can't imagine a country like that continuing to function. They're caught in a bind here. In this last election, there's all this stuff about the Palestinians or fifth columnists. We're talking about 20% of the population here. You know, the Arabs in Israel are a fifth column, which is kind of ironic because they're the native residents and the Israelis are the immigrants. And so you get people like Lieberman, who's an immigrant from Moldova, you know, talking about expelling the residents to make room for immigrants like Lieberman. So I think that they're caught now in this position. They can either make it a democratic country in which everybody has equal rights. They can expel the entire Arab population of Israel. It's called ethnic cleansing. Or they can establish a system of apartheid. And the track record for apartheid is not very good. It's not a stable system. And, you know, for the first time, there's been some serious traction developed around an international boycott of Israel after Gaza.
You can read Khan Hallinan's piece, Gaza, Death's Laboratory, dated February 11th at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. And you can try talknationradio.org and .com. As soon as we get our website back up and running, talknationradio@gmail.com if you'd like to volunteer to help us with that after our website was hacked. Thanks for listening.